Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. This Sunday marks the 25th anniversary of the signing of the Americans with Disabilities Act, the most comprehensive and wide-ranging civil rights legislation ever passed in the United States. Today, we take many of the accommodations this act made possible for granted. Closed captioning, ramps, designated seating and parking areas, and curb cuts, to name just a few. But for the 18% of the U.S. population with disabilities, these are essential needs that the ADA made possible. Today, the act is held up as a model for disability-based laws around the world, and my guest today tells the story of how a collection of Berkeley-based progressives joined forces with establishment conservatives to bring together a bipartisan bill. Even today, legislators across the political spectrum, from Tom Harkin and Orrin Hatch to Bob Dole and Steny Hoyer, refer to the ADA as the last truly bipartisan piece of legislation that passed Congress. Leonard Davis tells the story of the passage of the ADA and offers a really engaging account into how this piece of legislation was shaped and passed in his book Enabling Acts, the hidden story of how the Americans with Disabilities Act gave the largest U.S. minority its rights. It's published by Beacon Press. Also, the book serves as a primer into how an idea becomes law. Leonard Davis is a distinguished professor of liberal arts and disability studies and English at the University of Illinois, Chicago. And he's our guest today on Studio Tulsa. Leonard Davis, welcome to Studio Tulsa. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Very happy to be here.
Yeah, White House, everyone is celebrating the 25th anniversary of the Americans with Disabilities Act. And at the beginning of your book, Enabling Acts, you remind us, you know, so many of the changes from the ADA are just sort of, we take them for granted now, I think, 25 years on. But you have a wonderful section in the beginning of your book which describe what life was like for people with disabilities, say, in the 1970s when this movement began to take hold. Can you describe what that was like?
Yeah, and I think I probably was putting it even a little farther back from the 1970s. But, I mean, for example, my parents were deaf. And, you know, as deaf people, they had no civil rights in the sense that they couldn't do what other people did. I mean, they had jobs, but of course they went to school where they were just taught trades, so that they didn't have the advantage of being able to do anything beyond that. They had no interpretation. They couldn't watch TV and understand what was going on. No closed captioning. They couldn't go to the doctor and have an interpreter. They couldn't go to the hospital. They couldn't go to places of worship. There were no interpreters there. So they were really, as long as they were in the deaf community, they were fine. But outside of that, they were in trouble. And then, for example, if you think of someone like a wheelchair user, there was only a couple of choices. You could either stay home and be taken care of by your family, or you could be institutionalized. But to have a job, to go to work, first of all, you could maybe get your wheelchair out of your house if it had a ramp, but most didn't. You could go around the block, but not anywhere else because there were no curb cuts. There were no buses or trains or any form of transportation to get you to work. So hypothetically, you might have a PhD, you might be an engineer, but you couldn't get to work. So life was very limited. If you were deaf, or if you were blind, again, there were no traffic lights that allowed you to know when the lights were changing. It was just a world that was filled with barriers and inaccessible.
And as now 25 years on, most of those items that you describe, we take for granted. And even people who would not even consider them part of the disability community utilize them in their everyday life, whether it's ramps instead of climbing a flight of stairs, or using closed captioning on a television in addition to actually being able to hear it. So it's really amazing what's happened over this 25 years. And when you look back at the dire predictions of naysayers who thought that this act was going to bankrupt business. And in fact, I think from my perspective, I think a lot of the retrofitting and spending was actually a boon for the economy.
Well, that's right. I mean, one of the arguments for passing the ADA was to say that you're going to get people with disabilities working, they're going to spend money, they're going to be able to come into your store and spend money, so it would be good for the economy. That was at least the initial rationale. I just wanted to go back to one point you were making, which is what you're talking about the unintended advantage for people who are not disabled or not yet disabled, is that it's something we call universal design. And the idea is that you design the world so that it's available to everybody. I mean, closed captioning, as you said, is a great thing if you're in a bar and it's noisy and you can't hear. Or I use it when I watch Scottish films and I can't quite understand half the dialogue. I just put the captioning on. It's also the curb cuts benefit, parents with strollers, rollerbladers, older people who have trouble maybe getting up a little higher, doorknobs that, are not the traditional round ones, but with levers, help everybody. I mean, they don't hinder anyone. So the idea is the more accessible you make the world, the better it is for everybody.
Well, what's really interesting about Enabling Acts is you tell the story of a movement towards a important civil rights victory, and you sort of, we always say the process of making laws is like making sausage. You get into the ingredients of the sausage, and as I was reading through the book, it was really interesting to see how that process unfolded. It was a long process. It didn't happen overnight, and it was a persuasive case for making a case, for getting a bill introduced into Congress, and then negotiating the various interest groups, as well as pro and con, to get the bill passed. And as I was reading, I kept thinking of, here we've had this summer, marriage equality, another major civil rights, and I hope somebody writes the same book about this, that struggle 10 years, 20 years from now. But this is what you've done with Enabling Acts. And as you write, you said really the beginnings of the ADA go back to about 1973. And it was a little clause in Section 504 of what was then the Rehabilitation Act. What was important about that little clause?
I do want to come to that. I want to just touch on something you said. When I wrote Enabling Acts, you could write a really dry book about the passage of the law. I'm also a novelist, and I tried in Enabling Acts to make it a kind of page turner, to get into the personalities, the hidden deals and secret things going on. And also for me, it was just a learning experience to really understand how a bill gets passed. I mean, everybody's seen that cartoon, like, I'm just a bill, but it's a lot more to it than that. And just seeing the personalities and the difficulties to come up with a bill this encompassing and this important that meets the needs of, let's say, almost 20% of the population was really exciting, and I'm glad that you found it to be that. So what happened was in the Rehabilitation Act of 70, there's this little squib. It's like, I say it's a tweet-length clause that basically says anyone who's otherwise qualified should have the rights of anybody else. So the otherwise qualified concept then got written up in regulations that are quite enormous, and those really lay out the groundwork, although not every part of it, for civil rights for people with disabilities. As I say, as I tell in the book, there's also a dramatic story of the fact that the bill was passed in 73, but the regulations, which really are the thing that make the bill work or that enforce the bill, didn't come out for years later. The social activism and political activism to get 504 regulations out was really what started the disability rights movement.
Yeah, you mentioned a gentleman named John Wodach who was charged with, I guess, writing those regulations.
Yeah, he's still writing them, actually. he's now, I think the last regulations for the ADA, and remember, this is 25 years ago, were written up about 5 years ago. So the regulations keep having to be written because there are so many new situations that arise, and then you need more regulations.
But he was charged with writing those Section 504 regulations, and I think the whole thing was the bill passed and there were powerful opponents that didn't realize that was passing until it was already a law.
Well, nobody knew that 504 was in the bill, or in the act. It was kind of discovered afterwards. And apparently, no one's really clear who put it in. Some intern, there's a name floated around, but basically no one has claimed credit for it. And it's interesting because it had such a big effect. But once word got out, as you say, there were powerful forces, particularly in the Reagan administration, wanted to deregulate, and one of the things they wanted to deregulate was what was going on with 504. And so when Carter took over, they still didn't have regulations. So the bill was passed under Nixon, and when Carter took over afterwards, Califano, who was the secretary of HEW, was dragging his feet. And so there was the largest occupation of an American, of a federal building in San Francisco. It lasted for 27 days, And that one finally forced Califano to sign the regulations and put into effect essentially a fair amount of civil rights for people with disabilities.
But that delay, and I guess the increasing awareness within the disability community that this section existed, sort of come up with a nucleus to really push for civil rights for people with
disabilities.
Absolutely.
I just want to correct something I said. It was Nixon, and then Carter came in. When Reagan came in, he was trying to deregulate 504 after it had been institutionalized.
Yeah. Well, through the course of the book, you share the story of the activists who are working for the ADA and the legislators who are working for passage of the bill. And it was really interesting because one of the things that really strikes you is this ADA, and you make several references in the book, and many of your interviewees make reference to this. So this is one of the maybe the last major acts of bipartisanship in Congress.
That's right. I interviewed over 50 people for writing this book, and many of them were people like Senator Bob Dole, Senator Tom Harkin, Steny Hoyer, Orrin Hatch. I mean, a wide range of people and a wide range of political views. And all of them said that they don't think the ADA could have been passed now. And it's interesting because it's such an important part of American life, and it really shows us that the roadblocks that we now experience to bipartisanship are really harming the country. And, you know, when you go back to that era, what you had was George Herbert Walker Bush, who was a Republican president, with a House and Senate that was controlled by the Democrats, which is exactly the flip of what's going on now. But they were able to pass this major piece of legislation with so many moving parts and affecting so many aspects of American life. And obviously, they didn't agree politically. But conservatives like Orrin Hatch worked very closely with liberals like Teddy Kennedy, even though they opposed each other on so many other issues, to get this thing through.
And because disability touches such a large percentage of the population, I mean, we're talking,
18%.
18% of the population. Most of these legislators that were key on it had personal experience with family members or themselves who have experienced discrimination and lack of accommodation for their disability. Bob Dole would be the perfect example from his war wounds.
Dole had war wounds, and he was the most visibly disabled of the politicians. But, you know, it was partly because they were motivated, the ones who had family members. But it was also because the disability activists who came to Washington, and there were a group of them, who decided right away that they were going to focus on Congress. They were only going to include people in the inner core of politicians who were people who had direct connections with disability, because they knew that they would be the most motivated to get the bill through. And also, it turns out that George Bush Sr. Had a lot of disability in his life. He had an uncle who had polio, a much-loved uncle. His brother was born without the use of one eye. He had a daughter who died of leukemia, and two sons with disabilities. One had a colonoscopy, and the other was profoundly learning disabled. So Bush got it. He understood it. And it's interesting now, and I interviewed him for the book, he's now a wheelchair user. Hmm. And he is appreciative of the fact that curb cuts and ramps and so on that came out of the bill are now benefiting him as well.
Yeah. Well, now tell us a little bit about the activists. There's a long line, and you actually, there were nicknames for each of them. Justin Dart, Patricia Wright, Arlene Meyerson, Bob Funk, Mary Lou Breslin. But Justin Dart is sitting right next to the president when he signed the bill, was probably the leader of this anti-discrimination movement for people with disabilities.
Well, he was certainly the one that was most visible, and he certainly did a lot of work. He was an incredible character. And by the way, I was just at the White House 2 days ago, and there was a wonderful celebration for the ADA, and Justin is passed on, but his wife, Yoshiko, who was very important, and I talk about her work in the book, was there, along with many of the people that you just mentioned, Arlene Meyerson, Pat Wright, Lex Fridin. So the thing is that Justin Dart was the kind of ne'er-do-well heir to Walgreens, and he was so self-proclaimed. He got kicked out of, he went to Andover, I think, and he said he was the only person who was worse than him and got kicked out of classes and so on more was Humphrey Bogart. But he kind of went around, tried a number of different businesses, made a go of some things, failed at others, He was, by his own admission, a womanizer, a drunk, an addict. But he pulled it all together, literally, on a mountaintop in Japan, and came back to the United States. His father was in Reagan's kitchen cabinet, very influential. And Dart, who had had polio, and his brother had polio, too, was a mover and a shaker. And the thing that he was really good at was going around the country. He went to the 50 states, like, five times with Yoshiko, and met with people with disabilities all over the country, collected their diaries, and in a scene from Miracle on 34th Street, took them all and threw them down in a Senate hearing, you know, piles and piles of them, to show that people around the country had ideas and about the way their civil rights were violated and what should be done.
How influential were those discrimination diaries? Because, as you mentioned, he did travel the country, mm-hmm. and he had an idea of what an ADA would look like, and as he traveled the country, he realized, wow, this is far bigger. I thought there was one solution. In fact, there are thousands of solutions.
Yeah, I think that's an interesting point because, you know, to a certain extent, if you read the book, the there was a lot of insider action, a lot of small core of people driving the ADA forward. But what Dart did was he really brought the grassroots point of view in. Interestingly, because he was himself from the elite, but he refused to live that way. You know, he even now Yoshiko lives in this one bedroom, two bedroom apartment that they lived in the whole time in Washington. But he went around the country and he listened to everybody, and he was responsible in some sense for an early draft of the ADA that was based on what he heard, and the diaries were, you know, they were a publicity stunt on some level. But they were influential because of the origins of them, where they came from, how each individual person wrote about their own experience.
Yeah. My guest today is Leonard Davis, a distinguished professor of liberal arts and disability studies in English at the University of Illinois, Chicago, and the author of Enabling Acts, the hidden story of how the Americans with Disabilities Act gave the largest U.S. minority its rights.
It's a long title.
It is. And what's really amazing about this process was fairly early on, the legislators who understood this issue were sympathetic, but the way the process of becoming a law is so interesting because a good idea can't become a law unless there is a groundswell of clamoring and demand that this become a law. And that was one of the interesting things to me was like, well, this is a great idea and we should do this, but until I hear from constituents that this is what needs to be done, it's not going to be done.
Right.
There was a whole campaign to lay that groundwork.
You know, I mean, if you ever want to pass a law, I'd say read Enabling Acts because it really tells you how you can go about getting something as complicated as this law passed. And it was a lot of work on the part of a lot of people. One of the things that you're saying is that there was a notable march on Washington, but the pressure really came from a very coordinated group of people who reached out to local groups, independence living centers throughout the country and people with disabilities and had them go visit, call their congressperson, and really put that kind of focus in front of the congressperson or the senator. And that was done very deliberately. It was also done in an era before the internet was really going, so there was a lot of faxes flying and phone calls, and that part was a kind of, it was like a war. It was coordinating a war. Then there was also, so there's that aspect of bringing pressure on the, but then there was also the sort of inner core of people, Arlene Mayerson, as you mentioned, Pat Wright, Chai Feldblum, and a number of other people, Bob Funk and Evan Kemp, who were every day meeting, strategizing, coming up with, lobbying people, working with aides, I mean, with congressional aides. It was a very complicated set of maneuvers that took a lot of energy and a lot of people. But I think one of the things that's also interesting, and I mentioned this in the book, is that in some ways you got all that coordination, and then it comes down to something completely whimsical, like a bridge game. You know, so every Thursday night there was this bridge game, and Evan Kemp, who was a really good bridge player, was a wheelchair user. Turned out that one of the people he played with was C. Boyden Gray, who was a super conservative Republican who was George Herbert Walker Bush's legal counsel, and when he became president, Boyden Gray became the counsel to the president. So there was this, they also had this direct pipeline from sort of like the lefty hippies who came to Washington and crashed on the floor of Evan Kemp's apartment, they had a direct line to C. Boynton Gray and to George Bush. So you've got all the planning, but you've also got this whimsical thing. Like, if it hadn't been for the bridge game, who knows?
You know, 1988, I think you write, was the watershed year towards passage. And really, if you looked at it on the surface, the Reagan administration is ending. And instead of a Democratic administration, the Bush administration's coming in. If you really weren't aware of just a sentence in, I think, one of the elder President Bush's speeches, which did mention the rights of the disabled, you would think there would be very little chance of passage. Lowell Weicker, who was perhaps the biggest congressional champion, lost re-election. And yet this was the year everything began to come together.
Right, and also Tony Coelho, who was Majority Whip, resigned mm-hmm. over a scandal. So you would have thought that the two people who were really pushing it, Weicker and Coelho, suddenly within 3 months are gone. So that also was an interesting roadblock that was overcome. I mean, Senator Harkin took up the cudgel, so did Ted Kennedy. Well, Kennedy had been doing it all along. And Steny Hoyer in the House took over from Coelho. So there was enough of a kind of momentum for people to pass the baton along and have the leadership involved in that way.
What's also really amazing about the Americans with Disability Act is it's not just physical disability. It's mental disability. It's hearing loss. It's vision loss. And every one of those groups wanted to be accounted for in this act. So it was a delicate balancing act in all the provisions. Like, we take closed captioning for granted, but that was a big struggle to get television industries and motion pictures to consider something like
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and another big thing was the telephone relay system for deaf people. You know, if you're deaf, you can use a TTY to make a phone call. There'll be a hearing person at the other end of the TTY who will then call up the person that you want and have that person speak to the hearing person who will then teletype to the deaf person. I mean, this is before iPhones and the internet, but
right.
But that, yeah, something like that is extremely complicated, and you know, you can imagine tremendous roadblocks to that. In addition, I mean, I just think like that if you say like there has to be a curb cut on every corner of every street, four curb cuts because of the way corners are, four curb cuts on every street in every tiny town in every city in the United States, you can imagine the chorus of like, we can't do that, that's too expensive. And also, wheelchair lifts on buses. I mean, that was a huge thing. The bus industry and municipal transports were screaming, you make us do this, we're going to go broke. But it all got done. And now it's just part of the landscape.
The name of the book is Enabling Acts, the hidden story of how the Americans with Disabilities Act gave the largest U.S. minority its rights. My guest is its author, Leonard Davis. 25 years, the anniversary is coming up this weekend. 25 years on. What has worked best about the ADA, and what has not worked out as planned?
Well, I think the thing that's worked best is, well, number one, just in terms of a zeitgeist, I mean, people recognize that people with disabilities are a group and that they have civil rights. I think before then it was just, oh, there's a blind guy over there, there's a deaf woman there, there's a kid who can't learn properly in school, he must be stupid. I mean, so just the general sense that disability is an identity, that disability is a social political issue that's related to civil rights, I think that's huge. On a more practical level, now, you know, in terms of public accommodations, there is a tremendous opening up of things like hotels, movie theaters, restaurants, even regular stores. I mean, people say, you know, in the book I compare a little bit the ADA to the 1964 Civil Rights Act. And the Civil Rights Act was obviously of huge importance, but it was actually of fairly limited scope, and it didn't have a financial consequence for business particularly. So what Justin Dart used to say is that the 64 Civil Rights Act said you had to open the door to people, and that the ADA, 1990, said you got to rebuild the door. So it had that consequence, and you know, supermarket aisles are now wider, and drugstore aisles are wider. These are things we may not notice. You know, of course, there's the curb cuts, there's the captioning. So these things are very important. And there's the anti-discrimination laws. I mean, if you look at the website for the EEOC, they're handling about 27,000 claims a year for people who say they've been discriminated against in employment situations. That wouldn't have been possible before. So those are the good things. As people say, there's much that remains. The biggest area that didn't work was employment. Mm-hmm. The current rate for people with disabilities is they have an unemployment rate of about 75%.
Wow.
Which is huge. I mean, as I say, the people with disabilities are the largest minority in the United States.
That's 18% of the population.
18% of the population. They're the poorest minority. 35% of people with disabilities live in poverty. They're twice as likely to make less than $11,000 a year, twice as likely than people who don't have disabilities. So it's a big deal. And actually, with the baby boomer generation, I think the statistic is that 50% of people over 65 are disabled. Mm-hmm. So it's a huge part of the population. But to go back to the employment issue, that's a problem. That didn't work. And probably why it didn't work, there's at least two or three reasons. One is that it was basically, the law was an anti-discrimination law. It didn't do anything to make people hire people with disabilities. It basically said you can't discriminate. And the only way that that could be enforced is if you brought a lawsuit against the company that you felt discriminated against you. So there's the issue that it didn't provide incentives for businesses to hire people with disabilities. And that, I think that needs to be worked on. We do know, for example, that in Japan and in the European countries, the unemployment rate for people with disabilities is about 12%. So compare that to 75 to 80%. And the reason is, in those countries, there are incentives for businesses to hire people with disabilities. There's better job training and transitional help for people who've developed disabilities, and that can be done. There just needs to be the will. One area where there is success is in the federal government. Federal government actually has a pretty good employment rate for people with disabilities. Partly that was because President Obama did an executive action a few years ago saying that more people with disabilities need to be hired. And executive actions like that could be done in states as well. So that area needs to be worked on. The other major reason that the unemployment rate is so high is that for people with disabilities who are on benefits, whether it's Social Security disability insurance or just a SSI for people who are poor and haven't really worked at all, you get your benefits, and they're not huge, by the way, but you get your benefits, but you will lose them instantly if you go to work. And so it makes sense, like if you're working, and you can earn more money than you're getting on disability, that's fine. And it's not that wouldn't take much. SSDI is about $13,000 a year, and SSI is about $8,000 a year. So that's one thing. But you also lose, like, for example, if you're a person with disabilities who has a personal assistant, you lose the personal assistant. You might lose a lot of your health care benefits. You might lose the technology that allows you to go to work. So there's a disincentive in that way, and the benefit thing needs to be, rethought so that people with disabilities can go to work, can get off of certain benefits, but can maintain other benefits that would allow them to go to work.
That would allow them to go to work. Well, the name of the book is Enabling Acts. Leonard Davis, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Leonard Davis is a distinguished professor of liberal arts in disability studies and English at the University of Illinois, Chicago, and the author of Enabling Acts, the hidden story of how the Americans with Disability Act gave the largest U.S. minority its rights. It's published by Beacon Press. The ADA will celebrate its 25th anniversary this Sunday. Well, that's Studio Tulsa for today. Our program is produced and edited by Scott Gregory. The views of our guests and commentators are their own and do not necessarily reflect the views of KWGS or its licensee, the University of Tulsa. I'm Rich Fisher. Thanks for listening.